And I do believe we're recording.
Great. Hello, I'm Simon Mercer. This is Crave, the podcast dedicated to film, music, TV, theatre, anything else that's been entertaining Steve McCabe and me lately.
And the films up for discussion this week are about as far apart on the popular culture spectrum as really you could actually expect to get. On the one hand, we've got a serious, a gripping and a frankly brilliant drama about the most serious of subjects, the Holocaust, and how British self-styled historian, we shan't grant him the dignity of the title, David Irving, tried to deny its existence during a famous court case about a decade ago. The film is called Denial.
Yep, we'll have a lot to talk about that one. Now, I only need to say out loud the title of the second film to say maybe all you need to say about it. But, you know, Steve and I, we'll find more than a word or two to add to it. It's The Fate of the Furious. Furious, yes. Might describe, perhaps, Steve, anyone watching this expecting a serious action drama. But having said that, there are one or two wee little treasures hiding in this latest in the Furious franchise. And that
really?
Is a franchise.
Isn't it just? Yes.
I think this is the eighth feature-length film.
Oh, Lordy.
And apparently there have been a couple of other shorter films as well. I mean, it's gone on for, like, at least a decade, maybe 15 years. So
it has a life of its own, doesn't it?
Oh, I'm sure they're not going to stop yet.
No, well, why would you? Why would you?
It's called making money.
Yes. Oh, you little cynic, Mercer.
Oh, I know.
Yeah. Now, anyway. Now we don't usually talk about film trailers, do we?
Not too much.
No,
but
this week we've got the release of a big Marvel film with a very strong Kiwi connection, and we can't let that pass, obviously. Last week's New Zealander of the Year. I mean, I thought one of us was up for the title, surely. but last year's New Zealander of the Year, Taika Waititi has directed the big budget film of the year, Ragnarok? Ragnarok?
I think Ragnarok is how I've heard it said.
Then we'll go with Ragnarok.
Yeah. Yes. So the trailer's come out this week. A lot riding on this film for the Marvel people. So, and if you've had, it came out just a couple of days ago, so it's only a couple of minutes. You might have had a chance to have a look at it. Steve and I have a thing to say or two to say about it. And now, Steve, I think you were not yet in New Zealand in the mid-1970s, were you?
No, I hadn't yet had the privilege.
In fact, I don't know if you were born in the mid-1970s.
You're too kind, but yes, I was.
But if you had been around... I would have been fascinated to hear what you would have made with your British sensibility of the madcap yet very dry humour of a man called John Clark, who became extremely famous here when he created a character called Fred Dagg. It was an archetypal Kiwi farmer, a bloke's bloke. Clark very sadly died this last week. Came really out of the blue, a real shock. And we'll have a thing on a thought or two to say about him a little bit later towards the end of the podcast.
Yes, he should not be allowed to pass unmarked.
No, and he won't. But
in the meantime, let's start with Denial. And
yes.
And I'll just say up front, I thought it was phenomenal.
Woohoo!
Get out of the
way. That's good. I thought it was really, really good. I had a couple of... I thought I'd totally recommend it. One or two little things about it slightly... didn't quite work for me, but only little things. But let's move on.
Let's do the setup then, shall we?
It's
a true story of a well-known moron named David Irving. Hey, look, we're allowed to say that legally.
He's
been found guilty pretty much of moronity in this particular context. He's a Holocaust denier, and that is a fact of law. He's a Holocaust denier who's attempting to sue an American academic named Deborah Lipstadt and her publisher, Penguin Books, over a book that Penguin published by Lipstadt called Denying the Holocaust. And in that book, Lipstadt accuses Irving of deliberately falsifying history and of manipulating and distorting historical documents to further his loathsome little personal ideology. He was basically a fan of Adolf Hitler.
I think that's fair, isn't it? He pretty much was.
He speaks very highly of the man. God knows why. And he tried to suggest that Hitler had nothing to do with the murder of the Jews, largely, in fact, because there was apparently, according to this moron, no mass murder of Jews.
Yes, that was what he had to say. And the drama of the film is about, as Steve said, the story of the libel case he takes against Lipstadt. And this actually, as court cases often do, don't they, Steve, they stretch over years. I think it started about the mid-90s. And yet that actual trial, which was held in London, was about April 2000. So it's 16, 17 years ago when the verdict was rendered. The film has some pretty top-notch actors in it. Rachel Weisz plays Deborah Lipstadt. Timothy Spall, he's a great actor.
Oh, yes.
He plays David Irving. And Tom Wilkinson, a very also very well-regarded actor, is Richard Rampton, who's the barrister whose job it is to confront Irving in court. And there are lots of other good actors in it too. So, Steve, you call it phenomenal. Let's pick up on that. What was it you really thought worked so well for this film?
Well, look, basically a lot of the film, well, at least the first half of the film, revolves around the preparation for the trial.
Yes.
And in particular, it revolves around Rampton, as depicted, as you say, by Tom Wilkinson, preparing and then justifying his defence for the trial. And you also have, in addition to the actors that you've just mentioned, you've got an amazing, I hesitate to call them a supporting cast.
Yeah.
Because you know, it's an incredible cast in and of itself. I'm just looking at the cast list on IMDb as we speak. So, for example, you've got Andrew Scott, who will forever, in my mind, be Moriarty in Sherlock.
Yes, yes.
As Anthony Julius, who was the lead solicitor in the case. And obviously this is going to play to an American audience as well as a British. And so there's a need to explain the difference between a barrister and a solicitor.
Yes.
The way the whole thing is written by director Mick Jackson is absolutely super. I beg your pardon, writer David Hare, Jackson director.
Yeah.
Yeah. David Hare manages to put the exposition of that concept in Julius's mouth without it sounding like someone who is explaining something to an audience.
Yeah.
It feels like this needs to be explained. It feels like this is an authentic, genuine conversation. The same thing happens as they're discussing legal strategy. When Rampton's trying to explain to Lipstadt why he doesn't want her to give evidence, they're explaining and justifying their legal strategy. And they make that compelling. Now, that's not an easy task to pull off.
No, I think actually that last point, in a way, that's one of the key tensions in the whole film, isn't it? Because Lipstadt, as played by Rachel Weisz, she wants to talk. She wants to say how outrageous it is that Irving is daring to say these things. And what's more, she wants to bring Holocaust survivors to the court so the court can hear firsthand about the truth of what the lies that Irving is perpetuating. But as you say, it's the fact that the lawyers representing Lipstadt say, no, that's completely the wrong thing to do. We don't want to give Irving the chance to cross-examine them because Irving's representing himself. We just want to point out what an absolute charlatan and a fraud he is. Don't make it about the victims, make it about him. And the fact that Lipstadt is struggling with this emotionally so much is one of the great tensions of the whole film. And that works really, really well, I agree. Actually, just on the Andrew Scott thing, Steve.
Yeah.
You mentioned that he's so well known for Moriarty, and I think he played a Bond baddie in the last film too.
Yes.
I thought it was quite interesting to see him playing the good guy. That was quite a change.
Yes.
I thought this was kind of interesting, just as a matter of difference.
In fact, a slightly naive, innocent good guy.
Yeah. It was good. I just you talked also, Steve, about the preparation for the film and the first part. There's one of the most compelling scenes, and I thought it was really it's difficult to use the word well done because it's so awful. But they visit Auschwitz in preparation for the trial. The first thing that struck me about the way they showed that scene was just it starts with a couple of quiet, still shots of the camp, or what's left of the camp.
Slightly uncomfortably lingering shots.
Yeah, and there's no music for a few seconds. It's just quiet, and it really hits you. I thought they'd handle that very, very well, if that's the right word to use. Yeah,
no,
compellingly so.
Yeah, and then after that, after about halfway into the film, we then move into the trial itself. And I don't know if you realise, I mean, it makes sense that they do this, but the dialogue for the film is lifted directly from the court transcripts.
Yes. Well, what fantastic dialogue that is. I mean, there are a couple of interchanges there, Steve. I thought were just fantastically well delivered, both by Irving and by Tom Wilkinson as the two main protagonists in the court. There's a famous scene where Irving says, "Oh, where are the holes? You know, no holes in the roof of the gas chambers. Therefore, there was no gassing. Therefore, there was no Holocaust."
Yes,
that became a headline, an infamous headline for the press. And then later in the film, we get the reply from Tom Wilkinson's character, and he delivers that just brilliantly. I thought that was totally gripping.
It was quite magnificently done. I mean, you've got two amazing actors there, given very, very meaty dialogue. And I mean, I don't know about the screening you were in, but certainly when I saw it, I mean, let's face it, this is a historical drama. We're not going to worry about spoilers here. When Rampton is dismantling Irving, every time he landed another blow, there were actually cheers in the audience. I mean, first of all, yes, Spall does a fantastic job of teasing out the loathsomeness, not merely of Irving's opinions, but of his personality. I mean, the man was a reptile, let's be absolutely clear about this. And so Spall does a beautiful job of depicting that, managing to make what he says sound almost plausible until you start to scratch the surface and realise that obviously it's not. But then Wilkinson just very calmly, very systematically takes him to pieces.
Yeah, it's one of the best little scenes, courtroom scenes, I've seen for a long, long, long time. Yeah, I think you're right. Spall has this way of letting you see the sliminess and the shiftiness of
Irving. Oh, shiftiness, yes, I'll take that.
You can almost see him thinking, you know, the cogs are shifting. He's trying to think, how am I going to deal with this latest attack? I mean, he's playing a loathsome character, and he does it very, very well, I thought. But I just want to ask you, Steve, the only thing, for some reason, I'm still dwelling on it, Rachel Weisz's performance, or maybe it's just the way it was written, I wasn't drawn to her quite as much as I was to some of the other performances in the movie. And I thought that it was laid on a little bit thick. There are a couple of scenes where she's in London and she explains that her name means, that she's kind of a fighter for justice. And you see her out alongside the statue of Boadicea, you know, the warrior queen. And that was just starting to lay it on a little bit thick. I don't know. What did you think of her performance?
I was a little bit torn on it. On the one hand, obviously, you know, it's a historical character. And you have to do your best to deal with the character itself.
Yeah.
But at the same time, they did try and... It felt... And I'm going to be very careful how I word this now. It felt as though somebody had the great idea of doing sort of a contrasting, a fish out of water kind of story of the brash American New York Jew in calm, understated London, and it didn't work. And it's like this is like sort of gave up on that idea, but there's still that lingers when you've got this sense of she wants to do the big, all guns blazing, grandstanding thing, and then you've got very calm, very measured, very sensible and sane and sober Rampton trying to rein her in, and her. I think partly it's the character was out of place, but I don't know necessarily they handled it quite as well as they might.
Yeah, I think you probably put the finger on it there. Because we know that's a sort of a character we've seen for decades. You know, as you say, the fish out of water story. I thought it was slightly overplayed, and the film didn't need it that much. I see that Rachel Weisz is herself on both sides of her family. She's of Jewish heritage, so I'm sure she was able to draw on some really authentic background to help her with the performance. I think she's a very, very good actor. I'm not suggesting for a moment otherwise. Maybe it was just I thought the accent seemed a little, I don't know, not quite right. I'm not sure. I'm being very pickety and not being very specific.
You're right to point that out. I mean, let's face it, you know, she's English herself.
Yes, she is. Yes, she is.
She's of Jewish heritage, but she is English. And there were moments when the Brooklyn Jewish accent... she was called that at one point, and she corrects them. The Queen's Jewish accent.
Yeah, that's right.
Did feel just a tiny little bit stereotyped to me, a bit hammed up.
I would go along with that. I think this is a relatively minor point. I mean, I would absolutely recommend the film. I think there are, it's, if you have forgotten the story of what happened there, it's worth seeing the film to remind yourself of it. There is some very good acting. There is some very good script writing. I like the line about the atom bomb defense that they're going to use to counter David Irving. And when he talks about Irving, I think it's the Tom Wilkinson character says, a coward only threatens when he feels pressure. And yes, that's what they're going to bring to bear on him. So it's, you know, really, it's a classy piece of work, no doubt about it.
I recommend it very, very highly. If you haven't seen it, then you should. Simple as that. Buy a ticket. Buy a ticket now.
I agree. You should buy a ticket to this. Right. Excellent.
Okay, so moving onwards, let's go to the far end of the spectrum. I mean, it's tempting to pull out the cliched sublime to the ridiculous remark, but would that be fair?
I actually think ridiculous is actually a very fair word to use about The Fate of the Furious. This is this eighth film of this franchise. And I say ridiculous in the sense, and I've been careful when I use that word, because ridiculous in the sense that these things, this is an action movie. Some of the stunts are so far-fetched, they cannot possibly, even remotely, be humanly possible or physically possible in this earth in which we inhabit. So ridiculous in that sense. That's not to say, Steve, that it's not entertaining, because in many ways it's very entertaining. I mean, have you actually seen any of the previous seven of them?
I have managed to resist their charms to date.
Well, that's what I had done as well. I similarly had resisted them. They just seemed to be all about men and fast cars.
Yes.
And I never thought that was, you know, I just didn't seem to really feel I needed that much of a testosterone fix. But yeah, but I took it one for the team, Steve, and went along to see The Fate of the Furious.
Okay, so what did I miss? Yeah. Convince me that I should go and see it. Come on, sell it to me.
That's a big question. Steve, what you've been missing out on is men in fast cars. Or actually, men and women in fast cars.
Ah, it's an
fast
equal opportunity cars. Nonsense.
Oh, yes, fast cars, big cars, sleek cars, indestructible cars, gravity-defying cars.
Oh, where has this been all my life?
I know. If you want a car, you go see this film. You see a fast car, you know, just, yeah. Now, there is a bit more to it than that.
I'd go and see Indestructible Men and Gravity-Defying Women. That would sell me. But, but for the cars, I'm not convinced yet. So come on.
Okay, right.
Sell it to me.
I did my very best. Well, the best thing, actually, one of the key things that will sell you this film is something I'm not actually going to be able to, I don't want to tell you too much about. I mentioned this in my website review. There's a scene reasonably early on in this film, Steve, that I was completely taken off guard by and surprised by, and I have to say absolutely delighted by, as was everyone else in the screening. I mean, people were just – you could feel the smiles beaming around the inside the auditorium. I don't want to say too much about it because I really don't – if you are going to see this, it's worth the surprise. All I'd say is that there's a big acknowledgement – of the culture of our part of the world. And I wouldn't want to say any more than that.
Okay, let me ask you then, what kind of car does it involve?
Well, I don't even want to answer that.
Well played.
I don't want to go that far. But I will tell you that there was, at the end of this film, people were applauded.
Oh, really?
Yes. But I actually think that this scene I'm talking about just engendered a huge amount of goodwill for the rest of the film. I strongly suspect, I didn't go around and ask everyone, but I suspect that the applause had a lot to do with that scene. Anyway, you might recall, Steve, even though you and I hadn't seen any of the previous ones, there was a lot of publicity generally, wasn't there, in the last film, one of the actors died during the filming, this American guy called Paul Walker. Do you remember that?
I remember the fuss around that and wondering, you know, was this time to hang up the car keys?
Yeah, well, he sadly died in a car accident, and they managed to cobble. I don't think he'd finished all his scenes, but they cobbled together enough to make the previous film, which earned $1.5 billion at the box office around the world. So they felt, well, we can't stop there. So what they've done here is they've moved the story on. This is a story of a bunch of fast car loving maverick do-gooders who run around the world, I guess, solving disasters, a bit like Mission Impossible or you know, sort of the, a Bondish sort of thing. And basically, I mean, that's what it is.
I mean, it sounds more like international rescue, to be fair, at this stage.
Yeah, actually, that's not a bad that's actually quite good. You could just substitute the the international rescue fleet for the cars, and you'd be doing quite well.
Oh dear Lord.
I mean, it is an action film, Steve. It's not like, I mean, they're action films, aren't they? It's not like a Daniel Craig type Bond or a Matt Damon type Jason Bourne, which, you know, had moments of good scripting and good directing and good almost believable stunts. This is far, far removed in a far different galaxy.
Oh dear.
Than that. It's leaps of faith. I'll give you just a couple of examples.
Give me examples.
Well, okay. I mean, I actually looked this up because I thought, when I saw it on the screen, I thought, these fast cars, I mean, they're going, I don't know, 200 kilometers an hour, something like that. They're racing across the ice at absolute full tilt, and a submarine breaks the surface of the ice and chases them and is actually catching them and almost basically, well, is at least maintaining speed with these fast cars. Could a submarine move that 200 kilometers an hour? I thought, no, this can't be right, surely. Surely.
So it's sort of a rocket-propelled submarine.
Something like that. I mean, but of course, then you have to just sort of take a breath and say, it doesn't actually matter because they're not trying to tell you that this could ever happen. All this is about is throwing a whole lot of spectacular sequences at you to hopefully entertain you. So there are cars raining down from up buildings on streets, and but other cars emerging unscathed.
Of course there are.
Cars defying all manners of the laws of nature and physics. It's just, it's beyond belief, and it's not meant to be anything other than that. There is a sort of a story here. there's a baddie called Cypher, played by Charlize Theron, no less, who apparently has turned one of the team against the rest of them, the team, well, one of the team leaders, Dominic, played by Vin Diesel. That's as much of a story as you need to tell. Happily, Steve, most of the cast play it with their tongues firmly in their cheeks. In particular, Dwayne The Rock Johnson, who we were talking about in Maui not that long ago.
Yes.
One of your fellow Brits, Jason Statham.
Oh, of course he would be in it, wouldn't he? This is his genre to a T, isn't it?
It is his genre. And there's a guy called Tyrese Gibson, and he especially plays it for laughs the whole way through. Kurt Russell's in it; he's quite funny. And when they are being funny, it is actually quite entertaining in a stupid sort of way. A couple of characters like the aforementioned Vin Diesel and Michelle Rodriguez play it straighter, and I don't think that's a good idea. But anyway, it's silly, but it is kind of fun. There are some ridiculous stunts, but you will probably just go, "Wow, that looks pretty amazing on screen." One of the things about it was trying to figure out what was a real car and what was a CGI car.
Oh, okay.
I suspect they had to use a bit of both because, some cars are real cars, but some aren't, and that's one of the challenges.
So I'm guessing like the gravity-defying cars would possibly be the fake ones.
Yeah.
Because my intuition suggests that might be the case, perhaps.
Yeah. But I suspect, I don't know, I think this film's only just been released, but you've got to bet it's going to make a truckload of money, and that
would that be an indestructible gravity-defying truckload?
It would be the very same. And the franchise will roll on for another installment in a year or two, maybe. I mentioned Jason Statham, another well-regarded British actor of the highest esteem.
Oh yeah,
also appears.
Go on.
One Helen Mirren.
Really? She's she's a proper thespian, everything.
I know. So there you go. She has a bit of fun. So there it is. You know, you just got to, if just suspend your belief, and if you want to have just a bit of a fun night out, it is just silly, but it's funny at the same time. That's all
okay.
I could
well,
say.
Well, I'll tell you what, I was sort of wavering and maybe thinking it might be worth a look, but as soon as you mentioned Helen Mirren, yeah, go on. Then if she reckons it's worth a punt, then I'll. you weren't quite selling it to me, but Helen does.
Oh, great. Oh,
nothing personal.
Cool. No, not at all. I'm not sure if I want to sell it to you. Anyway, so I think we should move on from there. We'll change gears.
Oh, and, very. I see what you did there, mate. Very good.
Oh, I know. Oh, yes.
This film clearly made an impression on you, didn't it?
it's all that testosterone coursing through my veins after seeing all that the rubber burning on the road. That's what it is.
There you go. Yeah, we're flogging this metaphor beyond reasonable bounds, aren't we?
Yeah. We'll move on. Okay.
Moving onwards. So we've done two complete films. Shall we talk about a snippet of a film?
Yes, do let's.
We don't often analyse the trailers for films, do we? But I have to be honest, this one kind of comes under the heading now of very slightly Kiwi neediness.
I think you're right.
because we've finally got a significant Kiwi doing a very, very, very significant film.
That's true.
We've got Taika Waititi, who is now stepping up to the Marvel plate.
Yeah. And I mean, this is a big film. I don't know what the budget was, but it's going to be in the hundreds, more than 100 million, I would have thought. This is the film to be released at the end of the year, Steve, called Thor Ragnarok. This would be the third Thor sort of standalone Thor film.
So it is Thor 3.
Yes, it is Thor 3. Yes.
It could be before Thor 4.
That's right, yes. And so we've just, the news this week is that the trailer for this film has been released. So it's only a couple of minutes. I think you had a look at it not that long ago, Steve. Were you blown away or did you just yawn and think, oh no, not another superhero film?
Well, I kept thinking, do I want to see Thor 3? And after it, will I be glad I saw Thor 3? Which, trust me, is not easy to say.
But, it's not.
No, it's not. So I'll stick with the trailer. And I saw the trailer, which I can say. And by the end of it, I was starting to think possibly it was a spoof. It's obviously reached the point now, I think, where the Marvel Universe has realised that it cannot and it does not need to take itself at all seriously.
No.
I mean, you've got Jeff Goldblum in it. Jeff Goldblum. You cannot take this film seriously.
No, all right, fair enough, yes.
I mean, since we're not worried about spoilers for trailers, obviously. No. It's got the Hulk in it.
Yes.
We've got, what's his name? We've got Thor himself actually making snarky meta comments about the fact that it's got Thor in it.
Yes. I think that we use the word spoof. I think the word I've read, the reason the Marvel people brought Taika Waititi in to do this film is that especially the second film didn't go down very well with the critics. It did okay at the box office, but it didn't make critics sit up and really take notice. They thought it took itself too seriously.
After
films like Hunt for the Wilder People and What We Do in the Shadows, Taika Waititi has clearly become known as a guy who likes to have fun. And I think that's absolutely what they wanted. They wanted to have a sense of fun to this film. Very much, Steve, like The Guardians of the Galaxy, which I think you saw and you enjoyed. And there's a second one of those coming out shortly. So
yes, there is, isn't there?
So I suspect it's going to be quite like that, and in the Thor Ragnarok trailer, we hear Led Zeppelin Immigrant Song blasting out. So, it could be quite a Guardians of the Galaxy type approach, perhaps, which probably is a good thing.
It sounds very. I think what you just surmised there, I think, sounds totally reasonable. It's clear. I think you're right that they've realised that they can pull off films like Deadpool, for example. They can have fun. Yeah. With these films, yeah. they can have an awful lot of fun. Guardians of the Galaxy is another example. They can do this. DC can't. DC needs just to give up and go home, really. But Marvel have realised that they've got such a brilliant money spinner going that they can afford to take a day off and have a bit of fun. They don't need to, because you're right. The last Thor film was ponderous. It was plodding, and it was so far up itself. It was terrifying. It looks like someone said, "Look, boys, just lighten up, please. We're begging you."
Yeah. Well, you saw, Steve, you saw Hunt for the Wilder People, didn't you?
I loved every second of it.
Yeah. I mean, so if he brings any of that type of sense to this, it's probably going to be an enjoyable watch, I suspect.
Yes. If he brings, I mean, there was a joyous lightness to Wilder People that was just irresistible. It was, like I say, it was it was light and it was joyful. I can't think of other words to describe it. And if he can bring that sensibility, we're on to a winner.
Yeah, we could be. We could be. So, look, we'll look forward to that. It's not till, I think, October, November time. But I think, just my quick scouting around the internet, I think there's been a pretty positive reception to the trailer, which, I mean, it's only a trailer, but nevertheless, it augurs well.
It does indeed.
So that,
it does.
Yeah, so that's good. Yeah. But there's a kind of a sad note as well this week, especially for New Zealand, in the New Zealand popular culture world, Steve.
Indeed. I mean, I felt like we spent much of last year doing this, but we have someone we need to farewell.
Yeah. Have you, I don't know, because this guy has not been in New Zealand for a long time, so you may not have heard necessarily that much about a guy called John Clark, Steve.
No, I knew his work before I knew who he was. You can possibly tell me more about this, the wonderful sort of mock political interviews he would do in Australia.
Yeah, were really, gosh, they were good. The one I recall was when he conducts an interview with a bloke about whether the 100 meter running track is actually 100 meters.
Oh, I've not seen that one.
Okay, if you could look that one up on YouTube, hopefully be on YouTube.
There's a lot of them that are, yes.
Yeah, it's wonderful. And that's, I mean, that period of his career in Australia, I think he was based in Melbourne. You know, it's wonderful. It's good scripting. It's dry. It's well observed. But he actually made his fame here in the 70s with a different sort of a character called Fred Dagg. I'm not sure that's a name you necessarily would have come across since you've been here, Steve.
I have. There's a certain very real and at the same time very surreal edge to that humour. It was affectionate and at the same time very, very barbed.
Oh, that's actually, I think that's a wonderful summary of it, because I went back and had a look at a couple of, again, on YouTube, some well-known sequences that this character, Fred Dagg, this country bloke who lives on a farm with six sons all called Trev. I think on TV1 this week they repeated one of his first appearances, or maybe it was his first appearance. And
on Country File, I believe it was, wasn't it?
Or Country Calendar.
Country Calendar.
New Zealand's longest running television program. There's a scene there where this country lad, you know, man, comes to the city and doesn't know how to negotiate a pedestrian crossing. And he sort of doesn't know which way to run, and it's just ridiculous. And getting in and out of his car in town, he falls out as if he's trying to get off a horse. And when I went back and saw that again, it kind of made me think it's almost a Milligan-esque sort of physical humour there.
Yes, I can definitely see the connection. Even to the slight madness in the eyes, it's definitely there, isn't it?
Yeah, but other times it's much drier than that. But it made a huge impact here, I think. I mean, I was only, I don't know, 13 or 14 when Fred Dagg appeared on the scene, but I remember laughing out loud at his antics, and that other New Zealanders were doing the same. And it may have been one of the very, very first examples, maybe the first example of a New Zealand comic talent really poking fun at us, and us, who all take ourselves too seriously in this country, especially back then, laughing along with him.
Well, how could you not? Yeah. He was genuinely funny.
Yeah, and so he's got a special place, I think, in this country's popular culture for that reason. That said, it was interesting to go back because he released a lot of they weren't all videos; there was some audio, and there are a couple of examples I heard of material which would be extremely politically incorrect these days. But it's just a sign of those times. Mm. Especially about men and women, and you know, getting the Sheila, the wife, drunk to have sex with her, and stuff like that. Which you could hear that these days, but it was quite very risque back then. And I guess it was about him just pushing some boundaries out and doing all that sort of thing. But look, really, really talented guy. And very sad that he died at a pretty young age, I think 68 or something. So he's definitely a guy who made an impact here.
I woke up this morning with a text message waiting from my brother in England, because I'm flying back there at the weekend. And I've got a long, long flight. He sent me a video from YouTube, and he just commented, "Is this going to be you?" So I opened up the video, and it's a clip from Flight of the Conchords. where the Prime Minister of New Zealand arrives in New York and he's visiting. Well, the character's Murray, isn't it? Who's the
yes.
tourist attaché. And he's yes. sitting there in Murray's office and he has to be prodded awake because he's full of jet lag. And the Prime Minister of New Zealand was played by, of course, and as soon as he came on screen, I'm like, is that? It couldn't be. And as soon as he opened his mouth, as soon as you heard that particularly Richie Beno-esque voice, you knew immediately it was John Clarke.
It's John Clarke.
I thought, wow, this man gets everywhere. It's only after he died that I came to realise just how utterly ubiquitous he was. And all these people I've seen who've been profoundly talented, they were all the same bloke.
Yeah.
I thought, why didn't I know about this man so much sooner? I feel faintly ashamed.
I just while we've been talking, I've just done a quick search. If you go to YouTube, Steve, and you just search for John Clarke and 100 meter track, you'll find that one I was referring to. It's well worth a look.
I absolutely shall, then, because I am growing. I realize it's too late now, but I'm really growing to appreciate the man.
Yeah, I think he was very much a humorist who would have appealed to the English sense of humor more than the American sense of humor.
Oh, very much.
Yeah. Well, so there we are. So, Steve, you're away for a bit of a trip, huh?
Yes, I'm going to be missing a few interesting events, actually, while I'm gone. I'm kind of disappointed, really. This on Monday. Debbie Harry's coming to town with Blondie.
Right.
They're being supported by Cyndi Lauper.
Also, in their day, both very big names.
In their day, yes, but that was... it's probably not polite to discuss exactly how long ago that was, really, to be honest.
No.
Apparently, Debbie Harry's 71 now.
Wow.
I know. Who'd have thought it? We've also got, very shortly after that, a few days after, is Lindsay Stirling at the power station.
Mm-hmm. Okay, I'm going to plead ignorance. That's a terrible thing, but okay. Go on and license
electric
me about
violinist.
Stirling. Okay.
And then there's been a few interesting announcements of shows coming up.
Yes.
It's worth having a quick trawl through what's been announced, actually, to be honest.
Okay, go on.
Are you a Cat Stevens fan?
Actually, I can't. Well, I definitely was. I absolutely was. Yep.
He's playing, let's see, 1, 2, 3 dates. In December, he's going to be in Auckland, in Hamilton, and in Christchurch.
Yes.
He's announced. Take That.
Oh.
Now, there's a name you recognise.
Yes, I do.
Yeah. They're going to be... I've lost the word on my screen. They're doing Wellington and Auckland in November.
I know. Okay, yep.
All this is obviously on our website. You can get all the full information. Queens of the Stone Age, if you fancy a really sort of bludgeoning your head into the wall with heavy metal, are playing the Logan Campbell Centre, which isn't the most rock and roll venue in the world, but they're going to be there in July.
Okay.
Who else has announced? The Stranglers.
Oh!
Oh, yeah, they're coming back. They're releasing a Greatest Hits album. They're going to be touring that in February.
Okay.
They're going to be at the Town Hall in Auckland. And hold on to yourself, you're going to like this. Boney M.
Oh, wow.
Oh, yes. The 70s never ended, did they, Simon?
No, wonderful.
They're actually playing an impressive tour. They're doing Dunedin, Christchurch, Hamilton, Tauranga, Napier, Rotorua, Wellington, and Takapuna? Yeah, they're playing the Bruce Mason Centre. Okay. That's their one Auckland date. And oddly enough, even though they're playing places like the Bruce Mason Centre, they're also playing Horncastle Arena in Christchurch.
Oh, okay. All right.
Given the size of acts who've played there recently, I was kind of surprised when I saw that. But, you know, somebody knows what they're doing. They're also doing Claudelands Arena in Hamilton. So apparently they're expected to pack out decent-sized venues.
Wow, okay.
Didn't see that coming, did we?
No, I didn't. Right. Okay.
So that's what we have to look forward to in the near future.
Okay. Now, Steve, I just realised that can I just ask you something? Just whether you while you were telling me about Boney M, were you hearing a different soundtrack in the back coming through the our little discussion here?
No. Why were you?
Oh, good. I accidentally played. and I was hearing it in my own earphones, a trailer for a film which I saw. So I thought you were playing some music onto our broadcast. I thought, gosh, he's clever, that man, Steve. But all
if I were doing that, that would have to go in post-production. I'm not that clever. are you sure you weren't suddenly like struck with the vibe and started listening to Boney M on the slide?
I thought you were playing me Boney M at first, but it wasn't Boney M.
Well, no, I mentioned this. The email came in a couple of days ago in the morning, and I saw it over breakfast, and I mentioned it to my wife, Debbie. And she said, Boney M, remind me, what did they do? And I mentioned Brown Girl in the Ring.
Yes.
And she said, I don't remember that one. How does it go? She said, oh, it sounds to me. I said, please do not make me play it for you. Please, I'm begging you. She said, no, just play it for me very quickly. And I found it on iTunes, and I played an 8-second clip. And that was it. That was in my head for the rest of the day. She's an evil woman.
Yeah, once it's there, it's not getting away.
Oh, no, that was a bad thing to do to me, that was. It was
all right. Okay, actually, the trailer I was hearing was of a film that was actually, it was a trailer in that the Fate of the Furious, they played it. It's had a rave reviews overseas, and it's here just in a few weeks, Steve. It's called Get Out.
Oh yes.
It's kind of a horror thriller satire, apparently, and it starts off, I think, as a story of a white woman who has a black boyfriend, and she takes him home to meet her family. So, and the trailer starts like it's looking like some sort of cross-cultural drama, but it quickly descends into some sort of weird thriller. So it looks quite gripping and fascinating.
I have heard quite wonderful things about that film. It sounds dark, terrifying, and quite funny as well at the same time.
Yes. So I think it's not due out till the beginning of May, but that's not too far away. Anyway,
we shall make a point of catching up on that one, shall we?
I think we shall. We shall indeed. So Steve's having a bit of a break. You're away for at least a couple of weeks, aren't you, Steve?
I'm gone for a fortnight, but I will be back. I will be back.
I'm glad to hear it. I'd be bored listening to the sound of my own voice for half an hour, I can tell you that.
Nonsense. Not that voice, Simon, surely. No.
Oh, yes. Anyway. Let's wrap it up. You have a great trip, Steve, away. This has been Crave, by the way, obviously. The Crave. You can go to our website, which is an excellent idea because we've got written reviews and photo galleries and information about events coming up.
And we will have photos of Blondie and Cyndi Lauper probably Tuesday morning.
Oh, excellent. There you are. It's cravepodcast.com is our website. And if you want to email us, please do so. Love to hear from you. It's just email podcast@cravepodcast.com.
We're all over the social media, obviously. We're on Facebook. We're on Twitter @CravePodcast, creatively enough.
Where did you get that idea from?
Hours of thought.
Oh, yeah, as you can tell. Okay, so look, enjoy your Easter and whatever else you do over the next little while. I'm Simon Mercep.
I'm Steve McCabe.
And that's what's been entertaining us this week.
Fantastic.